This is The End User, episode 147 for Tuesday, September 24th. Too big, too late. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Mahar.
Taylor, we dropped a week there after the iPhone hangover because there wasn't a lot of news floating around, but we're back. We're back on our regular schedule on Monday nights, and it feels good to be back.
It does feel good. I'm happy to be back.
Now, right off the top of the show, I wanted to issue a bit of a correction from last week. We were talking about the 64-bit chip in the new iPhone 5S, and we were talking about 64-bit chips being
versus
required,
32-bit chips.
Right. Being required to have more than 4 gig of RAM, being that the limitation of the 32-bit chip is that you max out at 4 gig of RAM. And it turns out that's kind of a half-truth. So while it's true that typically in a 32-bit chip, you can only address up to 4 gig of RAM, the more modern ARM chips, which are basically in all of the modern 32-bit Android devices that we were talking about, they actually have a 40-bit width to address the RAM width. So that gives you a maximum of 1 terabyte of RAM. So it's worth noting, I guess, that actually, even though it's a 32-bit chip, you can, in fact, get more than 4 gig. And in the current landscape, 4 gig is, you know, still a pretty high ceiling, but the ceiling is even higher than that.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, 4 gigs on computers got pretty small by the time that that chips were, by and large, navigating to 64-bit CPUs. But I believe the limit on 64 bits is 16 terabytes of RAM.
We'll get there one day.
Right. Well, we'll probably have like 96 or 128-bit chips by then.
Yeah, I think by then we will have stopped worrying about it.
Probably. It feels like most people stopped worrying about it already.
Yeah.
I think they stopped worrying a long time ago.
Pretty much. So, I just wanted to issue that little bit of correction there because it's kind of interesting that the ARM chips can somehow cheat in a way to get around that. That's kind of neat, actually.
Yeah, I wonder how they decided to do that. But we don't have the answers for that, so let's get into our top news this week.
Yes, so the lead story of the week is that Microsoft has unveiled all of the details about the Surface 2 and the Surface Pro 2.
Don't you mean the Surface RT 2?
No, they are dropping the RT moniker, so it's just the Surface 2, and it probably should have been that way in the first place, don't you think?
Well, it makes it a little bit clear. Remember, when they launched the Surface RT, that was a brand new product category. There was no ARM version of Windows prior to that.
Yeah, so I'm glad to see that they're making things a little bit simpler. Although, I guess going forward, even though the name is simpler, the confusion may still be around a little bit.
Yeah, it might be. But I'll tell you, I like the look of these new Surface tablets. And I'm very much impressed that they have finally upgraded the resolution on the Surface 2. The original Surface RT came with 1366 by 768?
Yes, I believe that's correct.
And they've upgraded it to 1080p.
Right, so now it's 1080p, and the Surface Pro originally was 1080p. So the Surface RT of old was a little bit downgraded. I guess that's one of the components they must have cheaped out on.
I suppose so. Now, what are the other things that we're getting with these new Surface tablets?
So it basically looks the same. They've got this distinction between the Pro and the regular Surface, in that the Surface 2 is only coming in that silver color that you see. If you follow through on the website, they've got pictures of these things. So they're kind of trying to distinguish between the two models by giving them a little bit of a different color, even though the case is pretty close to being the same.
I thought the Surface Pro was a lot bigger than the Surface RT, and they're pretty much keeping the same thing. I mean, you would need to to pack more powerful machinery in there.
Yes, and it is bigger, but it's, I mean, really, in the grand scheme of things, it's not a lot bigger. But if you were to hold these two things in your hand, you would definitely say that this is substantially bigger.
All right, so we got a new screen on the Surface 2, and it's the same screen as the Surface Pro 2, or close enough. And we can presume that both of them are faster, and they probably have a better battery life, right?
So the new Surface 2 is going to have an 8-hour battery life, and that is just about the same as the old Surface RT. So the Surface Pro, however, is also going to have up to 8 hours battery life, and that is a substantial improvement over the Surface Pro of old.
Yeah, but still, I was expecting a little bit more than that. I mean, Apple's iPads are universally getting 10 to 12 hours on a charge. Yeah. All of their new MacBooks are getting, except for the smallest MacBook Air, they're pushing towards 12 hours per charge on that. So is there anything else that Microsoft is doing to give these Surface tablets better battery life?
Well, the savings in the Pro come from the Haswell chip upgrade. So this is a Core i5 Haswell chip in there. And Haswell says, you know, on the cover of it, that you're going to get about a 50% improvement in battery life.
Of course, which is how Apple got those same improvements.
Yes.
And pushed them up to 12 hours. But Chris, I was trying to give you the perfect segue into talking about their new battery cover. So they have their smart covers, you know, the thin touch type cover, and then a full actual physical button keyboard. And the new keyboard has a backlight in it. But then they've announced a third keyboard, which has not only physical buttons and I presume a backlight, but it's also got an extra battery in there.
Yeah, so you can get a little bit more juice out of the device. And this goes hand in hand with their docking station that they're also talking about, where you've got a couple extra USB ports, USB 3 ports, that is, an Ethernet port, and you can hook up your external monitors to this dock. So this could be, if you were the kind of person who wanted the solution where you have a dock and you carry around the computing power and you just dock it into your external monitors, then that's pretty attractive. Now, I've always thought that, well, okay, just put the computer under the desk. You know, we have the technology to just have another computer. I'm not obsessed with carrying it around all the time. As long as I can get all of my stuff to talk to each other over, you know, over the network and in the cloud and that kind of thing. As long as that's the case, then I just put the computing power there. I don't want to, you know, oh, I forgot my computer, therefore I can't sit down at my desk now. That seems kind of bad. But I do know that a lot of people think that way. They think, well, I'll just take one device and that's it, and I'll be done with it. And this would be a pretty neat way to do that.
Right. Now, we've had this conversation on the show before, you and me, where I try to make the argument that sometimes it is indeed better to have just the one device. Even if you can get everything talking to each other, it's not quite as seamless and simple as just having one device. But the question here is that the Surface RT, I don't think that is going to cut it for the majority of Windows users in terms of getting the full power to not have a separate laptop or a separate desktop.
Wait, but you mean maybe the Surface 2?
Yeah, the Surface 2, but maybe the Surface Pro 2 can. What do you think that the Surface Pro 2 has what it takes to be a normal user's only computer?
Yes, absolutely. It's a Haswell mobile Core i5. I think that is plenty for most people. Now, you start to talk about audio engineering people or video editors, you know, forget it. It's out the window. It's
not going to work. Oh, of course not. And those people know enough that they're only looking at these as toys.
Yeah, but absolutely. A Core i5 can absolutely serve most people.
A college student would be good to go with this.
Oh, yeah. I would think so. In fact, I think a lot of people could get away with the Surface 2 alone. They'd have to readjust their life a little bit because you're not going to get the app compatibility with the older Windows apps. But I think you'd be surprised how many people could just get away with not having a full-blown laptop at all.
All right. Well, what are the prices on these? Because I remember that the first generation of Surface tablets had their prices dropped considerably over the last few months.
Yeah, that's right. They basically put them on fire sale and lost a bunch of money selling them. So what we've got is the Surface 2 is coming out at $449. It's going to be out and in stores on October 22nd. And the Surface Pro is going to start at $899, and you're going to get the ability to pre-order today. That's September 23rd. So by the time you listen to this podcast, pre-orders will have started.
Interesting. Well, yeah, I'm looking forward to reading some full reviews of these. They've only just announced them hours before we recorded this, so only a handful of tech reporters have even had their hands on them.
Yeah, so this will be the last thing we talk about here, but let's talk a little bit about the covers just a tiny bit more. They've got this cool looking Bluetooth adapter for the touch and the type covers, and the touch and the type covers, like we mentioned, are basically the same as before, but they're backlit now. But they've got this little adapter that you can snap onto it that will allow you to remove the keyboard from the Surface and kind of walk away a little bit.
Oh, that's pretty cool. So it presumably has a regular amount of Bluetooth range.
Yeah, so it's that thing is $60, but I think the idea is kind of that you can sit down at your desk and dock this thing and then detach the keyboard and put it down on your desk, and it will hook up to the monitors and you'll have a desktop environment now.
That's pretty awesome. I like that feature a lot.
Yeah, isn't that neat? It's not something I would have thought of for sure, but that is a great idea.
I agree. Now, I'm not... Oh, yeah, I do see it, that there's backlit keys on all of these covers.
Yeah, even the touch cover, which doesn't have the depressible buttons like the type cover does.
Right.
So I think... at a more meta level, I think these devices look very interesting, and I think this is what the Surface should have been in the first place. And I guess it took them one iteration to get it right, and that's always the case, isn't it?
But yeah, it takes everybody an iteration to get it right.
I actually do think the original Surface devices were pretty good. They screwed up the pricing a little bit, and they had to eat some money in the long run with that device. And I think it was a decent first shot, but this is the polish. So I think this is where it gets a little more interesting. It'll be more interesting to see if consumers latch on to these than if consumers latched on to the devices from last time around.
Right. Well, this is cool. That wireless adapter seems really cool to me. And the dock could make this a really useful desktop, laptop, tablet thing. And they've also launched a special mouse that's designed just for the Surface.
Yeah, so I think it'll be a pretty decent device. So, you know, of course, we have to get our hands on it to actually express a full opinion about it. But from what I can see, they're polishing the old devices, and they've got the same kind of case on them, and I like what I see.
Yeah, me too. I can't wait to read the reviews. But in our next story, it is not looking quite so bright for BlackBerry, who last week announced that they were releasing a statement of their operating costs and that they were expecting to lose about $1 billion the last quarter alone.
It's only one Instagram, you know.
Well, that did not discourage their new prospective buyer, which they announced only days later, Fairfax Financial Holdings Limited, who has agreed in principle to buy BlackBerry for $4.7 billion, a mere 5% of its peak net worth in 2008.
Ouch. That is a really rough valuation. I know that BlackBerry has had a rough time of late, but that is not looking good for them.
It is really not.
Although, I guess, is it looking good for them? Because now they have some ability to do something. You know, before they are, you know, they're kind of beholden to their stockholders and they have to take actions to save the company. And I feel like if they're privatized, then maybe they could focus on making devices. Or do you think this is a play for patents? Or I'm not sure what to read into this.
Well, Fairfax Financial already was one of the major shareholders of BlackBerry. They owned about 10% already, and they have an agreement in principle to buy back the rest of the stock from all the other shareholders. So they will, in that sense, still be beholden to some of the same people who owned the company. But it's really hard to say. They are basically a large multi-industry insurance company. And so their plans for what to do with BlackBerry will be probably up in the air at this point, and much too complicated for us to understand at this point. Although it's a good bet that the primary value of the company at this point for Fairfax or any potential buyers would be the intellectual property rights that they hold from patents.
Sure, I could see that. So the just to put this in perspective, if you remember, Microsoft bought Nokia's devices business for $7.1 billion as compared to this $4.7 $4.7 billion price.
And in that case, we learned exactly what Microsoft was paying for the licenses to Nokia's patents, which Nokia, the remainder of the company, is going to maintain over ownership, and what they were paying for the mobile technology business. But in this case, they're buying the whole company. But then again, $4.7 billion is only 90% of the company, since Fairfax Financial already owns about 10%.
Yeah, sure. Well, with that said, BlackBerry, at least in the meantime, until this deal actually happens, keeps trucking along. And they've released some details about the new BlackBerry Z30. And that is a 5-inch that's a 5-inch smartphone. And it's got the BlackBerry OS 10.2 on it. And it's got a 356 PPI screen, 720p, 2 gig of RAM, no pricing details. What do you think? I think this is it's actually a pretty nice-looking device.
It is, and it's heartening to me because it proves that the phone makers at BlackBerry are still paying attention to what the other companies are doing. But I think even when they announced the Z10, our impression was it was probably going to be too little too late. And this is, well, at 5 inches across, it's too big too late.
I didn't think about it like that. But yeah, I think it's funny because I look at what they're doing with the software on this device, and I actually kind of like it. It looks like a new way of doing things in a way that we just didn't need yet. We didn't need a reimagining of how touchscreen input quite works. But I did like what they're doing. You know, at least they were innovating in something, and I really like to see that from them. It's a little bright spot here in BlackBerry world amongst the news of the acquisition. So I don't know. It's of course I haven't gone out and actually used one of these things, and I've never seen one in the wild. So I can't imagine it's all that popular. But at least they're trying to innovate on something, and I can respect that.
I think I have seen a few Q10s around, and if I saw a Z10, I'm not even sure I would recognize it, you know, unless I saw the BlackBerry logo on there.
Yeah, there's a big old logo.
The Z30 is, it is a distinctive and highly spec device. It's pretty impressive, but I just don't think that it can do what the Z10 couldn't.
Yeah. And it makes me look at Windows Phone and think, oh, well, they're doing pretty well.
Yeah, just because you're doing better than BlackBerry.
Yeah, it doesn't mean you're okay.
And Windows Phone's future is pretty much hinging on Nokia, and look how that's going.
Yeah, so only the future will tell, but no other company has been able to kind of solidify themselves as number three, and Windows Phone has come the closest, but they still have a very small market share. All right, well, let's get into a bit of software news, and this is our last top news story of the week, and I found this to be slightly confusing, and it is quite kind of interesting. It kind of captures your imagination a little bit, and we'll see what actually happens with this, but Valve is talking about releasing their own operating system. And Valve is the company that brings you Steam, and naturally it will be called Steam OS. And it's built on top of a it's built on top of Linux, and they're hoping to kind of enter the home theater PC market, it seems. So I don't know. What do you think? What's your take on this? This is a little confusing to me.
I didn't get a strong take on the home theater market. I mean, they are essentially planning to license this operating system for use towards first party. They're going to come out with their own Steam box, and then they're going to license it to other people who make these third party Steam boxes, so that you can basically have a full customizable computer platform that is designed around games and intended to go in your media center. So this is the open source answer to the Xbox One or the PlayStation 4, right?
Sure, and I guess that makes a little more sense. So they've got their own Steam box that they're going to use this on, and then they're going to release it so that everyone else can just use it on a device that may or may not be hooked up to a TV. That kind of makes sense.
Right. Now, one of the reasons that they said they were doing this is the founder of the company was quoted as saying, the gaming experience on Windows 8 is a catastrophe. Now, I was unaware that such sentiments were out there. I thought that gaming on Windows was, you know, chugging along just fine. That was always a big advantage that Windows had over Mac. But would you describe gaming on Windows 8 as a catastrophe, Chris?
No, that's definitely some hyperbole. Perhaps the gaming, you know, hardcore gaming in the Metro part of Windows 8 would be a catastrophe, because, you know, it's all the cartoony tablet kind of games. But the it's the same old Windows underneath. If you're talking about Windows on a desktop and you're gaming on it, it's the same old Windows.
Right. So Valve is coming out with this new operating system, and just like phone operating systems, they are entering into a very crowded market, and there's going to be some attrition there. Some of these platforms are going to die off. You've already got the Xbox One, the PlayStation 4, the Wii U, the NVIDIA Shield, which should be coming out soon, and then you've got all your Android-based platforms. And not to mention, Apple is making inroads with having games streaming to Apple TV. And there's a hardcore contingent of gamers who will continue to build gaming systems exclusively on Windows. So they're lucky in that they have a built-in market share of hardcore gamers who are using Windows right now and already downloading from Steam.
Yeah, they've got the lion's share of that market, the gaming
right.
on desktop.
But they need to lure a lot of those people away into getting a Steam box instead of a Windows PC.
Yeah, I think not everybody is going to move over to the TV. I mean, people who want to use a keyboard and a mouse with Counter-Strike, let's say. I mean, they're not going to, you know, put a keyboard and mouse on their coffee table and use a Steam box for that particular purpose. I'm sure they'll play other games on that kind of system, but I think the market for desktop gaming is small but loud, and I think the mass market for console gaming is very large, and they're kind of crossing the streams a little bit to me, and it seems like they're trying to get everything to work on Linux, and they're almost there, and they actually have a very cool feature where you can stream a game from a Windows box down to your Steam OS box, and that seems pretty cool. It's kind of a bridge from the days of old on the desktop gaming to the days of new on the TV gaming. So it's funny because they're kind of straddling everything. They're halfway into the console market, they're halfway into the desktop gaming market, and I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how people react to this.
I think the make or break thing here is whether they're trying to aim exclusively at the home theater market, or if they are imagining that people will use this as an actual desktop computer and try to get people to maybe dual boot Windows and Steam OS. And if they go one way or the other, they've either got to have really good dual boot or they've got to have really good media center capabilities if they're going the home theater way.
Now, I think they're going purely for games. And I think that the idea of Steam OS lives and dies with whatever hardware they put it on. If your market strategy is to, or at least in 2014, if your market strategy is that everyone is going to have a little computer under their TV, I'm not sure that's going to be a mass market hit. But what you do have is a console that runs PC games underneath the TV, and I feel like that could be somewhat of a hit. So I don't know. We'll see what everybody kind of reads into this as.
Well, I think we've said about as much as two non-gamers can say.
Yeah, I guess that's true. What would be really cool, if I can just go off the rails a little bit further before we kick on the afterburners, it would be awesome for them to step outside of the gaming bubble for a little bit and throw their hat in the full-blown home theater PC.
That's what I just said.
Yeah. I think that would be really cool. And I don't think they're going to do it. But if they said, okay, we're now supporting TV tuners and, you know, we're a full... We know that there's a niche of home theater PC folks out there that know and love their home theater PC, and this is the operating system for you, I think that would be kind of cool. But I think they're going to be focused on games.
All they have to do is, like, buy Plex or Boxy or something.
Yeah, there you go. No, I don't know. Boxy's part of Samsung now.
Yeah, well...
Yeah, maybe
Samsung's
Plex.
Samsung's not doing anything with them.
Maybe Plex. Yeah, so we'll have to wait and see where they're going with this, but very interesting development.
All right, well, I don't want to wait and see. I want to turn on the afterburners.
Yes, let's do.
All right. Apple had one of its most successful weekends ever. They sold over 9 million iPhones in their first weekend, selling them in 60 countries. They are almost completely sold out worldwide of the iPhone 5S. It's selling about as fast as it can. If you are looking for a white or gold iPhone 5S, you will have a very difficult time finding it. I would suggest going online and just ordering it as soon as you can, because you're going to be waiting a while. If you want a black one or if you want an iPhone 5C, there are plenty of them out there, although it might take some doing. They have their traditional appointment reservation iPhone pickup system, but if you try to go into an Apple store in the next week, it's probably bound to be a madhouse.
And HP has announced a new laptop, and what's interesting about this one is it is the first to integrate the Leap Motion device. Remember, this is the device that you can wave your hands around in kind of a Kinect-like fashion and manipulate things on the screen and the like. So this is the first laptop that has that kind of technology built right into the device, into the palm rest, as it were. And, you know, I don't know if it's going to light the world on fire, but it's kind of neat to see somebody actually take that and build it right into the computer as a feature instead of having a USB add-on.
Yeah, I've been imagining this ever since I first saw a demonstration of the Leap Motion, so I was pretty excited to see that. Now, Google has recently bought QuickOffice, and now they are announcing free availability for all Google Apps users to use QuickOffice on Android or iOS. And what that means is that you can either use their proprietary QuickOffice format, or it's interoperable with any number of formats, including Microsoft Office. So you can have Office documents edited for free on your Android or iOS device using QuickOffice. You don't have to get Office 365 subscriptions, which was what Microsoft was asking you to do to use their first-party iOS app. Or I guess if you're on Android, this is your only option.
Yeah, there are some other Office editing suites that you could use on Android. It's been a while, but they're out there.
But are they free?
Unlikely. So if any of the listeners know about one that's free, then please let us know.
All right. Google is also launching a new version of Google Wallet. They have removed the NFC requirement for their Android app, and they've launched Google Wallet for iOS for the very first time. So I guess it's basically like Square or PayPal, but it's Google Wallet. You don't need NFC anymore. So if you're really waiting for that, go ahead and download it.
Yeah, it's cool to see them kind of expand the platform and get it out onto iPhone. That's a pretty big deal. So Microsoft has announced the official pricing of the Windows 8.1 upgrade. So any users who are using Windows 8 in any form right now will get the upgrade for free. But we are going to have two versions. One's going to be $119.99, and the other is going to be $199.99. That latter one is for the Pro Edition.
Will I be able to upgrade from Windows 3.0?
I bet you could, but you'd have to upgrade to all of the ones in between it.
Ah, yeah, I don't want to go through the trouble.
But if you really wanted to, I'm sure you could.
All right, one story that we missed when we were off last week is Twitter made an announcement that they are going to have an initial public offering. That means they are going public. There are very few details about it yet. It's going to happen sometime next year, probably, but basically they have just filed the paperwork to begin the very long process of doing it. They are trying to add more partnerships for advertisement, and they have been courting major TV networks in order to do that. But basically, at some point, you will be able to buy stock in Twitter. We don't know when or why or how much.
Cool. All right. And with that, let's turn off the afterburners and we can get into the end user stories. You can undo your seatbelt if you like.
Okay. I'm going to leave it on just in case.
Just in case. It's just safer that way. So,
all right.
Top of the end user stories here. You, sir, have iOS 7 and you've got some opinions about it. What's going on here?
I have. First of all, I love it. It's fantastic.
I really liked it. I got to see it over the weekend, and I'm liking what I see.
I'm really enjoying it. It is great on the iPhone 5, which is what I've been using it on. I went ahead and loaded it up on my old iPhone 4, and I will tell you that it's very different. A lot of the cool eye candy is missing, and it's a lot slower. So if you are primarily concerned about speed on your iPhone 4, I would first recommend that you think about getting a new phone. And then I would second recommend that if speed's an issue, you probably shouldn't upgrade. But if you're not too concerned about either of those first two things, you should totally get iOS 7 on your iPhone 4 because most of the really relevant features are there and are very useful. Like, for example, the control tray that you swipe up from the bottom of the screen has things like sharing features, instant access to a flashlight, which was never a built-in option before, as well as lots of other things. The new notification center is really great as well, and the photo management is improved by leaps and bounds. It's a fantastic operating system. Now, for some people who are not the end user Futurist Prime, as I am, they may have some trouble adjusting to the new look, feel, and utility of iOS 7, which again is better than iOS 6 in pretty much every way. But if you are having trouble with it, I have loaded into our show notes a couple of tips, tricks, and hacks and guides, mostly from Lifehacker, which kind of help you get around it and understand it. Some secret features that you might not have known about. For example, you can change your visibility in AirDrop so that people can't send you randomly things. There's a new leveling feature in the Compass app. There are timestamps in the messages for every single message, just not groups of messages. And you can mark all messages as read, which you used to have to do via a hack in iOS 6. And you can now make audio-only FaceTime calls. So that's great if you want to call someone internationally, but you don't necessarily want to look at them the whole time you're talking to them. Or if you have an iPad and you want to make a call, and again, not look at the person. Or basically any situation in which you don't want to make a call over regular phone networks, because it sounds a lot better over FaceTime, even if you made a call over 3G. And finally, you can block any calls and messages from any numbers through your settings page.
Cool. So looking in from afar a little bit, because I don't have any iOS devices, I really like what they've done with it. I realize that a lot of people, you know, will be a little upset that things have moved, as they always are when Facebook changes something. But I think as that fades away, we'll look upon this as a change for the better. Now, what perhaps is a little out of character is that it just doesn't seem polished in the typical Apple way. From the kind of abstract perspective, all of the ideas, I think, are good ones. But people are finding little bugs in iOS 7 that that exist that weren't there previously. So, I don't know. Do you think it's a misstep, or do you think it's just a little bump in the road?
I think it's a bump in the road. They really had to do a lot of work, both in terms of design and in functionality, just in the last 11 months, which is when they started developing this. And in the meantime, they were issuing bug fixes and revisions to iOS 6. So they had a lot of people working on this for a really long time. They only had a year to do it. And it is a ground-up reimagining of the entire software of the phone. So I do totally agree that there are bugs in terms of things in the system that just break. I'm noticing that a lot more of my apps will just randomly freeze or crash. And I am assuming that those things will be ironed out as it primarily it falls to the third-party developers who made those apps to fix that. So as long as they're continuing to support it, they'll fix those bugs. But even in the functionality and the appearance of the phone, there are some missteps that when you're looking at it and using it on the phone, you realize that it's either distracting or it doesn't quite fit or it's not intuitive. And I think those will be fixed over the long run. And this has happened with every major release of iOS. There are bugs that come out, and usually 2 to 3 weeks before there's an 0.1 revision that fixes all of those major bugs, and they get more and more of them as the timeline comes out. So this is a brand new reimagining of the system. There are lots of bugs in it right now. I totally agree, but I think the functionality of it and just the sheer beauty to me is entirely worth it.
Yeah. So in looking at iOS 7 over the weekend here, I was thinking that, you know, this is modern looking in a way that iOS just kind of hadn't been in, I don't know, the past year or two. They've kind of, since they were the first to this touchscreen game, and by the way, I don't mean first, I mean the first to do it nicely, things have changed a little bit, and I think that the new design is definitely more pleasing. And now you can set an iOS 7 device off to the side and look at a modern Android phone next to it, and I can no longer say that the iOS device looks old anymore.
Right. It does feel like a brand new phone. It's really amazing.
Yeah, so I'm if they can get some live tile action, then I think they've really got everything that one could want.
Well, more and more of the icons are live. Actually, just about every first party app that Apple offers with the phone does have a live element in its icon now.
Yeah, so it's like the unread badge and stuff like that, right? And the
the calendar has for a while always displayed the correct date, but now if you look at the clock in the home screen, the clock is actually a functional clock showing the correct time wherever you are. Same with the weather.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know, if they get some ability to have third party widgets, then I think they would literally have everything that Android has in going for it.
Well, I think they've got a lot more going for them than that. All right, so you can hit up the show notes to find out how to hide apps and folders completely from your phone, or how to find everything that has moved around and you don't know where it is anymore, or even how to break into somebody else's iPhone running iOS 7, because as seems to have happened in the last few major releases of iOS, there are several lock screen vulnerabilities, some that can get fixed and some that cannot. But so far, nobody's found anything that gives you complete access to the phone. You can call any number you want to using the emergency lock screen. You can access photos. And I think there's one or two other vulnerabilities, but there's no way to break in through the lock screen and completely access the phone unless someone has the new iPhone 5S and only has their fingerprint sensor as the lock, because that has been spoofed by a group of German hackers using basic fingerprint spoofing techniques.
Yeah, so this is kind of interesting. They were able to, given a good image of a fingerprint left on some kind of surface, they were able to recreate the fingerprint and fool the sensor. So that's...
Yeah, you can't just lift a fingerprint from a surface with a piece of tape.
Right.
They had to scan it at 2400 DPI.
Right.
And then recreate the fingerprint with a precision 3D printer. But then they basically had carte blanche.
Right. So, you know, that is not that worrisome to me. I mean, it should be troublesome to you that it can happen like that. But what's really upsetting is that you can't change your fingerprints. You know, sometimes security mechanisms get subverted. And when they do get subverted, hopefully you have a way to reset them. And that is not possible with your finger. So I like it as a second factor, just like we mentioned last time we were on the podcast. I like it as a second factor, but if you're relying upon a fingerprint reader to be your sole and only method of secure access to something, anything, whether it's a phone or not, then I think you're being misled.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's doubly true in the case of the iPhone. So that's basically my review of iOS 7. I will mention more things if I find them. I could talk a lot more about it, but I would just be geeking out for no reason. So I wanted to mention one more Apple story this week, and that is they have made a major improvement to their iOS App Store. And that is, if the App Store detects that your phone is not running the latest supported software for whatever app you're trying to buy, it will now offer you the option to instead download the version of the app that was most recently compatible with that, whatever it is that you're running. This is huge for me because I have been trying to get a first generation iPod Touch to work as a remote for my Apple TV, but I can't find a version of the remote software that runs on iOS 3.1.3. Now, it still won't give me the option in the App Store to download the version that old, but I'm hoping that it will be added eventually. And I have gotten a few other apps that I couldn't have gotten before to now work with this first-generation iPod Touch, which is, at this point, 6 years old.
Neat. So you can at least breathe some new life into that old device with this. That's cool.
Exactly, yeah.
And I suppose that's a little greener, isn't it? Don't throw it away. Use it.
As opposed to just throwing it out. Yeah, I mean, I would recycle my old devices that I have no more use for. And I would encourage everyone out there to do the same. Functional reuse is better than recycling.
Right. Right. That's cool. All right. Well, I wanted to mention something, and then we'll get into your green tech story of the week. But Google has taken a pretty big step in online security and has flipped on HTTPS for everyone. So, in other words, Google by default for not logged in users will now use HTTPS. And this puts some analytics at risk. So, for example, when you go to your analytics on your website, you can look for the keywords that people were using to get to your website. And for non-advertisement use, you're not going to get those keywords anymore because all of the traffic is encrypted. So there are some ramifications in that regard, but I think it's definitely a good step for protecting the privacy of its users. So good on you, Google. And the one thing that's excluded from that is if you're clicking on an advertisement in Google, you do not get the same kind of protection. But I think that's a pretty big step for them to take, and I think it benefits their users, whether their users know it or not. And I think they've done a good thing here.
Okay, great. There must be some way around that if you really wanted to get those analytics back from Google.
Yeah, no, there's not really. What you do is you get this notion. I forget what they call it now, but the it's not provided is what you get. So some of that will, you know, people are going to have to deal with that. I mean, this is the privacy of users you were talking about, and you are just tracking keywords. So I think that's okay in the grand scheme of things, although I'm sure a lot of people will be a little bit upset about it. But I think it's a big win for the users of Google, which is everyone, almost everyone.
Right. Well, okay. I think this is a net win for consumers, for the end user, for sure.
Yeah, I'd agree. So we also may have a net win in your green tech story. What's going on here?
We might, especially for fans of Back to the Future. Now, this is going to spoil the first movie. So if you've never seen Back to the Future, you should probably stop listening right now. But it came out like almost 30 years ago. So you should probably just go watch it right now. But if you've seen Back to the Future, you know that at the end, the Doc comes back in the DeLorean, and the DeLorean has clearly been to the future, and it's all modded and stuff. And do you remember, Chris, it had the Mr. Fusion on the back? It looked like a coffee maker, the Doc just starts pouring garbage into it, and it just turns it into electricity and powers the car.
Yeah, it was a pretty good moment.
Right. So we are now, in 2013, we may be taking the first steps towards having a real-life Mr. Fusion. Now, it's not actually using fusion, but what it does is it captures the available carbon energy stored in organic waste. So this could be sewage, discarded food, anything with carbon-rich chemicals in it. Some researchers have developed a hybrid fuel cell battery that uses bacteria to convert the stored energy of the organic waste into chemical energy, and then uses an anode to turn it into electricity. And they have already reached a theoretical electricity conversion rate of 50%. 50% of the available stored energy in this waste has been converted to electricity in a lab setting. So this is not something that we're going to see on the market anytime soon. Again, this is just one of those
research
pipe dream things. But as soon as I read it, I thought of Mr. Fusion, and I said, well, this has to go right into the end user green tech story.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's cool stuff. All right. Well, you also want to take us away for the tip of the week?
All right. So, you know, I don't think we've even mentioned in our coverage of the iPhone 5S and the 5C that it does not have NFC. Now, most flagship Android phones and Windows phones are having NFC chips embedded in them at this point. But it's really not a feature that many people are taking advantage of.
Yeah, definitely not. I have had NFC on my phone ever since I got the 8X years back there. And I can tell you I have never used NFC once on this device.
Right. And it's a pretty simple thing to do once you get it set up, but people must be probably pretty confused about how to get it started and what you might even do with it. So Lifehacker has posted this nice little primer, which I can't use as an iPhone user, but if you are an Android user or a Windows 8 phone user with NFC on your phone, they have this great primer on just some cool things that you can do with it. And just go to the show notes and check this out. So you can turn your computer on and off. You can set up Wi-Fi tethering on your phone, share your Wi-Fi password, put your phone into driving mode, share contact info, and launch any number of other actions. And basically the way this works is once you set it up, there's just a physical tag that you can stick on a sticker somewhere and just swipe it over the phone, and all of those things will happen automatically. So it's really simple to set up, I presume, and there's no reason that you shouldn't be using it if you have it in your phone, which I don't.
Yeah, so you can even launch Tasker on Android, which can basically do anything. So that's kind of cool. With the caveat that I've never used NFC on this phone. What I got to do is order some of those tags. I got to just order them myself. You know, I'm not sure I can have any use for NFC just kind of walking around and being in stores and the like. But I could probably find
some. You've got to buy the tags, yeah.
Yeah, I got to get them myself and set them up. So,
but the good news is that they're really cheap.
Yeah, they are.
All right, so for the app pick of the week this week, I am doing something that is iPhone only. So, Windows and Android users, but you probably have an analog of this app somewhere out there. But I've been looking for this for a long time. This is an app called Wi-Fi to Hi-Fi. And what it does is it allows you to stream audio from a Mac to an iPhone. So this is great if you have a Mac running as a media center on your computer, or you just have your computer set up in your room and you want to be far away from it and just have audio going into your headphones wirelessly for whatever private reason that you would want. This is a 99-cent app. And it lets you stream audio from Mac OS to iOS. That's it. I've been looking for this for a long time. I found more expensive versions of it, but I didn't want to pay that much. 99 cents is not so bad, and I have not seen any useful ones for free at this time. So if you want this like I do, you should go ahead and pay the 99 cents. That's what I say.
Yeah, it seems like a cool application. All right, well, finally, we'll get to our kicker. What do we got here?
All right. So a few weeks ago, I learned via the internet, as you do, that the Soviet Union had developed a space shuttle program that happens to look pretty much exactly like the United States' own space shuttle program. And this week, I found out why. Because Ars Technica posted this delightful little secret history of the Soviet space shuttle program, which was known as Buran. They tell it pretty well, and it's not a very long read. They summarize it very nicely, and it's full of nice little tidbits of history, especially if you're interested in the U.S. space programs or international space programs, or the history of the Soviet Union, which especially in the last few years was clouded by mystery and classified documents. The thing looks exactly like the space shuttle. And you would wonder to yourself, why did they make that? And why did we not know about it? Because it actually did launch and achieve orbit and land successfully once. So if you're interested in that, as I was, you should definitely read this. It's a short read. It'll be available in the show notes.
This is neat. We'll have a link in the show notes, of course, like you said. But I had no idea that this happened. That's pretty wild. And you got to go through in the show notes and look at the picture of this thing. It's kind of uncanny.
Yeah, the pieces of information that we've received from the Soviet space program. Well, there were multiple Soviet space programs, but they were all shrouded in a great deal of mystery. And so, the tidbits that come out of them are endlessly fascinating to me. They're always fantastic, terrible, scary stories. That sometimes end well and sometimes don't.
All right. Well, it's time to get out of here, Mr. Marr. So if somebody were to try to contact you on Twitter, how would they do this?
Well, they would have to invent a space shuttle like the Soviets did and launch it into space. And then from there, they could tweet me at TaylorPhone.
Okay, that sounds like a good plan.
But you have to be in space, and it has to be in a space shuttle of your own invention.
Yeah, in fact, you're not allowed to at reply Taylor unless you are tweeting from space. I think, is that the right rule?
Yeah, that's why I only follow ISS astronauts and the Mars rovers. On
right. And you can tweet at me from anywhere. My Twitter handle is at Chris Hale Barnes. So give both of us a follow. Let us know what you think of the show. So thank you, everyone, for listening to this show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, over at thedigitalmediazone.com or theendusr.com. And you can go there. It's THENDUSR is how you spell the name of the podcast. The DMZ, of course, has a few other podcasts. You can listen to Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, the movie podcast, and Home On. If you'd like, you can send us some feedback. Our email is theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can follow us on Twitter. We are at @theenduser. Join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. We're back from our wacky schedule of before. I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime Taylor Marr.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.